Hi there. You're listening to the Hellenistic Age Podcast, Episode 96, Hellenistic Science, Medicine, and the Healing Arts. I swear by Apollo the healer, by Asclepius, by health, by panacea, and by all the gods and goddesses, making them my witnesses, that I will carry out to the best of my ability and judgment this oath and this covenant. These are the beginning lines of the Hippocratic Oath, the earliest known rendition of what many thousands of medical students recite each year across much of the modern world. The influence of the ancient Greeks on the history of medicine cannot be understated. And during the Hellenistic period, we see that several scientists and physicians built upon the earlier work of those like Hippocrates in radical new ways. In the first of several episodes on science during the Hellenistic Age, we will discuss the ways that medicine and the healing arts were studied, practiced, and advanced. While we are focusing on the scientists working in the time between Alexander and the Roman Empire, there appears to be almost no surviving texts dating to the Hellenistic period, outside of extensive quotations and paraphrasing by later writers who synthesized the materials of their predecessors. Some of the most important included Aulus Cornelius Celsus, who was a Roman author and encyclopedist living during the 1st century AD, who wrote on a number of topics, but his work on medicine survives and is quite extensive. But the most important heir to the Hellenistic tradition, and perhaps the foremost physician and writer on medicine in the ancient world, was Galen of Pergamon, who lived during the reign of the Antonine emperors in the late 2nd century AD. His enormous corpus has preserved much of our knowledge on Greco-Roman medicine after Hippocrates. In fact, Galen has had more writings survive to the present day than any other Greek or Latin author. Others like Soranus, Pliny the Elder, and Rufus of Ephesus provide us with additional snippets of information. And I will also need to rely on the Hippocratic texts, which, while predating much of our period, remained highly influential for many centuries afterwards. The ancient Greeks did not invent medicine. Medical treatises from Mesopotamia, Egypt, China, and India long predate the first known texts in the Greek-speaking world. What the peoples of Greece and Asia Minor may claim is that they were the first to articulate a non-supernatural cause to medical conditions, looking instead to the natural world for explanations rather than magic or religion. It didn't always start this way, nor were such causes universally rejected. In Greek mythology, the deities most closely tied to healing were Apollo, and especially his son Asclepius, both of them being venerated well into late antiquity. However, following the Milesian Revolution of the early 6th century BC, we see an increasing trend of Greek thinkers who look to nature as the source of phenomena. It is believed that such ideas were gradually being applied to the study of medicine, though its earliest history is hard to piece together due to a lack of sources. Alcmaeon of Croton was apparently one of the earliest pioneers in this regards, having worked as a doctor in the early 5th century, and the few surviving fragments of his work demonstrates a clear change in attitudes across multiple fields. But the most influential individual on the discipline of medicine was Hippocrates. Born sometime during the mid-5th century on the island of Kos, Hippocrates was the esteemed physician of classical Greece. His enormous body of work, known as the Hippocratic Corpus, was likely the product of Hellenistic scholars working in the Library of Alexandria, since the Ptolemies controlled Kos, and would have had access to the island's archives. While much of the corpus can be genuinely attributed to Hippocrates, the contribution of otherwise anonymous authors were grouped under his name as part of his general school of thought. He was reportedly the first to distinguish medicine from philosophy, though many of his theories are clearly influenced by philosophical outlooks. Hippocrates' work was carried on by his successors, and other traditions flourished during the 4th century. Outside of the Aegean, the doctors of Sicily and Magna Graecia had their own prestigious reputation. Empedocles of Agrigentum of the 4th century and Philistion of Locri in the 3rd century were some of the most famous, and their influence can be traced in the works of Hippocrates, Plato, and Aristotle. As something of a Renaissance man, Aristotle wrote about a whole host of subjects pertaining to the natural world and biology. He is the first to systematically study and organize animals, making observations about their anatomy and physiology, which earned him the title of Father of Zoology. This work carried over to the study of human beings as well. And although he may have earned criticism for some controversial propositions, such as the claim that females possess less teeth than males, he nevertheless provided several insights on the human body with direct medical application. What does it mean to be a doctor in the Hellenistic world? There was nothing akin to the highly structured track followed by modern medical students. Most training would have been informally acquired and had no set schedule. Places like Kos and, as we shall talk about in a moment, Alexandria, were hubs of medical knowledge. But studying at such places would suggest that the doctor in training had the finances to allow their learning. Once they felt sufficiently ready to begin their practice, they would do so on their own accord, often moving place to place to build up their reputation. There were also other types of healers, such as midwives and apothecaries, but a doctor in the traditional sense is typically referred to in our sources as iatron in Greek or medicus in Latin. Their social position could vary somewhat, and word of mouth would have justified their ability to earn a living depending on how successful they really were. If one was looking to ascend to the highest ranks, the royal courts of the Hellenistic world were always a viable option. The position of royal physician was very prestigious, and we have inscriptions celebrating the doctors of both Seleucid and Ptolemaic kings. Most of the famous figures we will discuss were tied to monarchies to some extent or another, as the patronage they received would grant them the cash necessary to acquire the relevant medical literature, and also engage in their studies with much more security. It must be understood that from the time of the Hellenistic period, scholars generally identify two main schools of thought when it comes to medicine: dogmatic, also broadly known as Hippocratic, and empiricist. As established by Hippocrates and his followers, the dogmatic school emphasized the importance of theory in the treatment of disease, and the most important and long-reaching concept was humorism. Influenced by the teachings of Empedocles, the health of a human being is dictated by four types of bodily elements, or humors: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. The qualities of these humors are in relation to the four primordial substances and four seasons. Blood is warm and moist, like air in the spring. Phlegm is cold and wet, like water in the winter. Yellow bile is hot and dry, like fire in the summer. And black bile is dry and cold, like the earth in autumn. If there is an overabundance or deficiency of any one humor, then the body experiences illness or pain. For example, when we catch a cold, we have an excess of moisture in us, which is demonstrated by our overproduction of mucus and phlegm. Geography and climate can also lead one to be predisposed to certain conditions, such as those living in cold and dry climates suffering from high levels of infertility and other issues. Thus, there are similarities between the natural world and the human body, and it is essential to determine the underlying causes of a condition using reason and logic, following the established theory. Dogmatists emphasize solutions not just focusing on the immediate treatment, but the prevention of future conditions by way of adjusting one's lifestyle, geographical location, and diet in order to provide optimal balance of the humors. Hippocrates argued that one should even adjust their eating habits based on seasonality, such as consuming more liquids and wet foodstuffs in the summer and reducing fluid intake during the autumn and winter. Perhaps the most infamous treatment to adjust the humors was bloodletting. There was a deep concern about the excessive retention of blood, which by its hot nature could result in fevers and apoplexy. So it was believed that a controlled bleed by way of incision or leeches would allow the body to return to normal levels and alleviate the condition. Obviously, we now know that such practices are incredibly dangerous outside of highly specific parameters, but bloodletting remained very popular until the 20th century. Further into the mid-3rd century BC, we get the empiricists, reportedly founded by one Philinus of Kos. In contrast to the dogmatics, the empiricists denied the role that theory plays in medicine. According to them, trying to ascertain the cause of illness is ultimately a waste of time, because there are so many variables to consider, and that adhering to the dogma of humoral theory, hence the name dogmatics, is not a productive solution when it is clearly not universally applicable. It is only through the process known as the tripod: personal observation, collaboration with other doctors, and by drawing comparisons to similar cases, that a physician can successfully diagnose and treat a patient depending upon the circumstances. The division between dogmatics and empiricists is in parallel to the schism between the philosophical schools of the Hellenistic period, which debated on whether we must look to nature and our senses to ascertain the truth, as espoused by the Peripatetics, or to trust only our own logic, the view of skepticism. This division was more of a gradient, though, as the two groups can agree on some aspects of each other's point of view and disagree with others depending on their particular beliefs. By the beginning of the 3rd century, Alexandria became the premier location for the study of the healing arts, and the city's claim to fame would be its contributions to anatomy, the study of internal and external structures, and physiology, the study of how those parts function and relate to one another. Prior to this time, Greek knowledge of the human body was rather limited. Outside of surface-level injuries suffered from accidents or in battle, our ability to observe the inner workings of our organs and tissues is incredibly challenging without X-rays, MRIs, and other modern imaging technology. The closest alternative we can get would be by looking at dead bodies. However, exploration was hampered because handling human remains was considered extremely taboo in Greco-Roman society. Funerals were limited to close family members who were quarantined from the rest of the community, lest they spread pollution, a semi-spiritual contamination of bad energy rather than a strict biological infection, and a special process of purification would have been demanded before the individual re-entered society. There was also the ethical concern about committing such an act, which could be perceived as a desecration of the human body despite being long dead. Animals were not subject to this restriction, and you can glean quite a bit of information by using other species as a comparative model, something which Aristotle recognized while performing his own studies. Yet one would never be able to gain the same level of insight versus handling an actual human body. Two figures challenged this taboo, Herophilus of Chalcedon and Erasistratus of Chios. Herophilus was a student of Praxagoras, a prominent physician during the mid to late 4th century who did his own research into anatomy, and once Herophilus completed his studies, he eventually moved to Alexandria to serve under the first two Ptolemies as both a teacher and a doctor. Erasistratus was his successor, working as the royal physician at the court of Seleucus I before making his way to Egypt to join in the flourishing medical school. Fragments of their work demonstrates a marked advancement in anatomical knowledge made possible by their ability to perform dissections for the first time in Greek medical history. Herophilus made several insights on the cardiovascular system, distinguishing the anatomical difference between arteries and veins, recognizing the pulse as being derived from the movement of the heart rather than the artery itself, and using the variation of the pulse to diagnose conditions. His was also the first detailed account of the liver, pancreas, and the duodenum, the last of which being the Latin translation of his own term, dodecadactylon, 12-finger lengths. Most important were his contributions to the nervous system. He built upon Aristotle's division of the cerebellum and cerebrum by identifying the 4 ventricles forming cavities within the brain itself, along with the complex network of capillaries, the choroid plexuses, which produces cerebrospinal fluid and forms the blood-brain barrier. He also made the critical observation of nerves, identifying the separation of duties, for example, motor versus sensory, and correctly noting that the brain was the source of these nerves, and, ergo, the seat of intellect, rather than the heart. Complex descriptions of the eyes also appear, such as the retina and other features. With Erasistratus, he seems to have built upon Herophilus' work and gets even more complex with his description of the nervous system, including making the connection between the increased number of folds in the human brain compared to other animals and our higher reasoning. The same could be said with the cardiovascular system, providing a detailed account of the heart, the mechanics of the valves, and the purpose of blood. However, he incorrectly believed that pneuma, air, flowed in arteries rather than blood, and uses the analogy of furnace bellows to circulate both blood and pneuma throughout the body. In this regard, both were adherents of the dogmatist school, seeing anatomy as a useful template that could be ascribed to all of humankind and allow for better application of theory. The advancements of the Alexandrian anatomists are quite remarkable, but scholars have been curious as to how they were allowed to temporarily overcome such cultural barriers. It has been speculated that these scientists got over the stigma of working with the dead through their exposure to the burial customs of the native Egyptians. The mummification process by Egyptian undertakers is famously recorded by Herodotus, who described the procedure with equal parts revulsion and curiosity. We can never know for sure, but the sources also stress that they had clear permission from the Ptolemies to perform their work. Pliny the Elder suggests that the kings were interested in the effects of illness on the body, but does not elaborate further. Perhaps the notion of going beyond traditional societal norms was a way for the Ptolemaic monarchy to acquire renown, as their protection would have been necessary to conduct such experiments in the first place. A more ghoulish tradition suggests that they did not just get approval to work on dead subjects either. More than one author claims that Herophilus and Erasistratus performed vivisections, using condemned prisoners supplied by the crown as live test subjects to make their work even more cutting edge. In response to this practice, the Christian writer Tertullian calls them butchers and haters of mankind. Despite being broadly in support of dissection, the earlier Celsus expressed his disgust over the use of living persons in their experiments. The historicity of such claims is quite controversial for obvious reasons, and while Tertullian's writings may be perceived as Christian polemic, Celsus seems to have little reason to lie. He even claims that the dogmatists argue about the morality of exploiting the suffering of a few men, who were to be executed anyways, for the good of the innocent majority. Medical ethics aside, the careers of Herophilus and Erasistratus marked a brief period in history where the scientific application of dissection was considered acceptable. Later Greco-Roman physicians chose not to follow the Alexandrian anatomist's path, some out of concern of violating the taboo. Galen preferred to have students observe bodies in various stages of decomposition rather than cutting them open for the sake of science. Others, like the empiricists, found fault with dissection on the basis that dead bodies function differently from live bodies, and that it would seem unjust to violate the deceased when such actions may render observations meaningless in the first place. Following this one brief moment in antiquity, dissection remained deeply frowned upon or outright illegal in medieval Europe and the Islamic world until roughly the 13th century AD. While rumors of vivisection abounded, it cannot be denied that the Alexandrian physicians put their skills to work on living subjects, but in a surgical setting to heal them. Their increased understanding of human anatomy enabled for advancements in techniques that not only would expand the scope of surgeries performed, but result in the creation of tools which improve the survival rates of the patients. Archaeologists have discovered surgeons' bags in many Roman sites like Pompeii, showing a diverse array of specialized instruments that were probably inherited from the work of earlier Hellenistic doctors. One small but important contribution was the general use of ligatures to seal off wounds to prevent hemorrhaging. Another is an S-shaped catheter used to drain the bladder, and attributed to Erasistratus. Such was the skill set of these surgeons that they were able to perform cataract removal or oversee operations on the liver, though the latter may have been only in extreme situations given the intrusive nature of the procedure. Orthopedic treatments also saw advancements. A 1st century Ptolemaic doctor named Apollonius of Citium wrote a commentary on the Hippocratic treatise on joints, offering solutions to deal with various skeletal injuries such as dislocations or fractures. It also gives us insights on the application of the Hippocratic bench, a device akin to a medieval torture rack, but for the purpose of decompressing the spine or setting a dislocated bone. Given the abundance of violence in the ancient world, it is not a stretch to imagine that many surgical breakthroughs were made as a consequence of wounds suffered on the battlefield. Diocles of Carystus is credited with the invention of the so-called Spoon of Diocles, a small hooked device which allowed for the extraction of arrowheads or other missiles from the body. Such a device may have been used on Alexander the Great when an arrow punctured his lung during his campaign in India, the most severe of his many injuries. A badly cut or broken leg couldn't turn gangrenous. An amputation was advised to prevent the patient from dying of infection. To compensate for the loss of a limb, the patient could be outfitted with a prosthetic, some of which actually could be quite complex in range and function. One notable example was a Roman soldier named Marcus Sergius Silus, who lost his right hand during the Second Punic War, and was apparently outfitted with an iron gauntlet that allowed him to hold his shield in place while his left hand wielded a sword. Severe head trauma from sword blows or sling stones could lead to conditions like intracranial hematomas, when blood pools inside of the skull and is unable to drain, causing intense pressure and potentially escalating into cerebral abscesses. Ancient physicians could treat this otherwise life-threatening condition by using a method known as trepanation. This involves a circular saw attached to a handle like a corkscrew or bow and pin, allowing for the surgeon to saw through the skull to directly access the intracranial cavity. The practitioner needed to control his speed and avoid hitting the dura mater membrane that envelops the brain, but with enough force to create a hole in the skull where blood can be drained. While this seemingly archaic form of neurosurgery sounds like a recipe for disaster, trepanation is actually one of the oldest known surgeries in the archaeological record, and the survival rate of these patients is surprisingly high given the number of skeletons found with clear evidence of healing even as far back as the Neolithic period. We have a fair bit of knowledge on ancient practices regarding women's health, specifically the realm of obstetrics, dealing with pregnancy, childbirth, and aftercare, and gynecology, the treatment of female reproductive organs. Ancient physicians noted differences between men and women with regards to health. Hippocratic doctors asserted that most, if not all, health problems affecting women were due to problems with the womb, more specifically the wandering womb. Because women's bodies tended to be overly moist, at least according to the theory, the womb on occasion could migrate into different regions and cause various conditions, such as infertility or epilepsy. Plato even likened the uterus to a wild animal that drove women to ill behavior. To fix such conditions, special treatments were needed, such as diets consisting of garlic and unfermented ewe's milk, or mixtures that were placed in the vaginal cavities that contained ingredients whose scents could coax the womb back to its proper place. Menstruation was also viewed as the womb's own way of expelling excess moisture. The Alexandrians were a bit more advanced in their understanding of female anatomy. Herophilus was the first to note the existence of ovaries, comparing them, with some small degree of error, to testicles in men, along with the fallopian tubes and a detailed description of the uterus. With the ability to perform dissections, Herophilus was able to refute the claims of Hippocrates by proving that the uterus was rooted to the body and therefore incapable of movement. He also denied that there were diseases that only affected women, but acknowledged that certain conditions, pregnancy, milk production, etc., were specific to them. Our sources on female health comes almost entirely from male doctors, somewhat understandable given the gender norms of Greco-Roman antiquity. Many treatments reaffirm these roles, such as viewing pregnancy and childbirth as essential for maintaining women's health, which would thus require male intervention. However, according to the Roman writer Hyginus, an Athenian woman of the late 4th, early 3rd century named Agnodike studied medicine under Herophilus while disguised as a man, which was otherwise illegal in her hometown. Upon her return to Athens, she became a renowned physician treating the women of the city, continuing her masquerade as a man to everyone but her patients. Her male counterparts grew jealous of her reputation and accused Agnodike of being a gigolo, but were shocked by the revelation that she was in fact a woman. Before she could be tried for her violation of the law, many of the city's leading ladies came to her defense out of gratitude for her services to them, and so the law was eventually repealed to allow females to study and practice as doctors. While the story of Agnodike seems like quite a fairy tale, there is plenty of evidence for female physicians operating in the Hellenistic world. For example, one Antiochus of Tylos, a daughter of a prominent doctor, was given honors on a statue which acknowledged her skills as a physician in Lycia during the early 1st century BC. However, we more commonly find women in the role of midwife, the Maia, who was primarily responsible in assisting with childbirth. They often possessed substantial first-hand knowledge and were ideally literate or educated. This is unsurprising. Childbirth, after all, was probably the most dangerous experience women went through in their lifetime. Medea famously proclaimed in Euripides' eponymous tragedy that she would rather stand in the hoplite battle line 3 times before giving birth once. Statistics vary, but mortality was generally highest for women during childbearing years, attested to by a great number of funerary inscriptions in Hellenistic Egypt acknowledging complications in childbirth as the cause of death. If conception occurs and the mother is unable or unwilling to carry the fetus to term, there was the option to pursue an abortion. Greco-Roman attitudes towards abortion were complicated, given the differences in philosophy about what stage life began, or even how it affected the Hippocratic Oath. Evidence suggests that it was seen as a necessary tool used to save women's lives, though it was heavily frowned upon if it was pursued in order to hide infidelity or to preserve one's looks. Herbal remedies could act as abortifacients and induce miscarriages, though the negative side effects on the woman's health were a deep concern given the inconsistent recipes used in the process. Hippocrates himself documented the final agonizing days of a woman who died as a consequence of the drug she took for her abortion. When complications threatened to put the mother's life in peril, such as breech births or hemorrhaging, then the difficult decision to save her life or that of the baby left the attending physician with a couple of grim choices. A cesarean section, a name commonly misattributed to the birth of Julius Caesar, would almost assuredly be fatal to the mother, but allow the possible rescue of the child. If the mother was prioritized, doctors and midwives were able to access the birth canal by way of a mechanical dilator, a speculum in Latin texts, and the use of a sharpened tool known as an embryo sophactis, which would allow the removal of the now deceased fetus. Some of our most marvelous sources of medicine come from nature itself. Pharmacology, the study of drugs and chemicals on living organisms, is derived from the Greek word pharmakon. These substances could range from organic materials derived from plants and animals to minerals and other elements, and could also invoke non-rational aspects like magic. Drugs were made available in oral or topical forms. It was quite popular to pair oral supplements with wine, and especially honey, which would help disguise the otherwise unpleasant taste. The Hellenistic period saw quite a large number of developments in pharmacology and associated sciences, which in part can be attributed to the increased connectivity of the Mediterranean world with that of Asia, which resulted in the discovery of new plant and animal species previously unknown to Greek scientists, and the trade networks stimulated by their demand for such products. The first key figure was Theophrastus, a pupil of Aristotle and head of the Peripatetic school in Athens from 322 to 288. While he dabbled in a number of fields including philosophy, he is best known as the father of botany, thanks to his work Enquiry into Plants. This was the first attempt to systematically organize plants, much like Aristotle did with animals. And along with general descriptions, he also listed their medicinal properties gathered from his own experiments along with knowledge from local herbalists and root cutters. His garden was gifted to him by the tyrant Demetrius of Phalerum, and it served as his final resting place upon his death. His works, along with those of the brilliant Dr. Dioscorides in the 1st century AD, remained the foundational texts on plants until the early Renaissance. Other important figures include Crataeus, who commissioned illustrations of medicinal plants to aid in their identification during the 1st century BC. Gardening and plant knowledge proved to be an attractive activity for the Hellenistic monarchs as well. Attalus III, the last king of Pergamon, was something of a green thumb and spent his free time planting. Unfortunately, this did not involve the cultivation of rose bushes or the growing of grapes, for Attalus had more diabolical tastes. Poisonous plants like hemlock, nightshade, and aconite were cultivated in large quantities to be mixed into lethal concoctions into the meals of his political enemies. His personal physician, Nicander of Colophon, was a well-respected poet who wrote verses on the pharmaceutical properties of venomous animals, poisons, and antidotes. Even more infamous were the activities of Mithridates VI of Pontus. Tradition long maintains that Mithridates was deeply paranoid about being poisoned, and made a concerted effort to prevent himself from being killed in such a fashion. In a process known as Mithridatism, the king ingested small amounts of poisons to slowly build up a tolerance or outright immunity over time. This is not necessarily a completely outlandish idea, as vaccinations work under a similar logic, as does allergy immunotherapy to reduce conditions like hay fever. The problem is that certain toxic substances, namely heavy metals like arsenic, lead, and mercury, accumulate in the body with each dose, and lead to chronic poisoning, thus making the treatment's efficacy questionable at best. Evidently, though, the process seems to have worked for the Pontic ruler. He also is reputed to have created the near-perfect antidote for poisons known as the Mithridatum. Sources disagree on its exact composition. Pliny the Elder claims 54 separate ingredients, whereas Celsus provides us with 34. Various plant parts like cinnamon, rose leaves, frankincense, and even turpentine were mashed into a powder, mixed into a paste, and then dissolved in a liquid. This knowledge made him a deadly opponent, having dispatched his mother, brother, and sister-wife with poison as his tool of choice. Ironically, this knowledge backfired, for when he attempted to commit suicide by drinking a vial of his poison, it had no effect on him, and he needed his bodyguard to run him through with his sword to finish the job. His personal library was taken back to Rome by Pompey shortly thereafterwards, translated into Latin by his freedman Pompeius Lanius, and the recipe for Mithridatum was later used by the Roman emperors. Returning to the discussion of pregnancy, there were a number of recipes to either prevent conception, contraceptives, or induce spontaneous abortion, abortifacients. The most famous of these plants was known as silphium, an otherwise unknown species of the Ferula genus and related to fennel. This herb was considered something of a wonder plant, used as both a contraceptive and an aphrodisiac, as well as a seasoning on food. While there were similar species found in the East, silphium only grew in the region of Kyrene in modern Libya, as it was too temperamental to cultivate, yet it was the most prized variety. The local Kyrenaeans were able to gain vast amounts of wealth from their monopoly over the plant since the establishment of their city, and went so far as to depict it on their coinage in appreciation for their prosperity. An ever-increasing demand for the plant led to its over-exploitation, fetching immense prices before it finally went extinct by the end of the 1st century AD, with the Emperor Nero possessing the last known specimen. Information regarding Greco-Roman attitudes towards conditions of the mind, my own broad category that would normally cover neurological conditions, along with mental disabilities and illness, varies in detail. There was a debate on whether it was the heart or the brain that served as the seat of intellect and the origin of sensation. Hippocrates and the Alexandrian anatomists argued in favor of the brain, while those of the Sicilian branch and Aristotle leaned towards the latter. By pinning the intellect to a physical location, doctors could therefore assign a physical origin to illnesses that affected the mind. Mood disorders like depression and mania were recognized, although the ancients believed them to be the byproduct of humoral imbalance. Epilepsy, a neurological condition marked by recurring seizures, is relatively well documented in the ancient world and is known as the sacred disease. As the name implies, common belief linked it to a divine origin, usually sent as a punishment. Hippocrates dedicated a whole treatise to its treatment, dismissing its supernatural origins in favor of a humoral cause. Julius Caesar is perhaps the most famous sufferer, with Plutarch and Suetonius claiming that he suffered from epileptic fits. Described as apoplexy, ancient doctors believed that strokes and brain clots were a consequence of too much phlegm around the aorta, but the word carried connotations of being struck down by the divine. Treatment for these conditions would have been limited, and despite all the benefits of modern medicine, we continue to struggle with neurological issues and mental health in the present day. And it is quite likely that individuals suffering from particularly difficult illnesses like schizophrenia would have had few options to turn to in classical antiquity. Though there was an increased emphasis on looking to the natural world for diagnosis and medicine, consulting the gods for solutions remained very popular. As stated before, the most important healing deity of the Greek-speaking world was Asclepius. He can typically be identified by carrying a staff with a serpent coiled around it, and his two most important sanctuaries could be found in the cities of Epidaurus in the Peloponnese and Pergamon in Asia Minor. But there were many other temples dedicated to him across the Mediterranean. Asclepius's children also embodied certain characteristics of the healing process. His daughters Hygieia, where we get the word hygiene from, and Panacea, the patron of cures, frequently accompanied their father in reliefs and statues, and are named alongside him in the original Hippocratic Oath. Prayers to the goddess Eleithyia would have been given for her aid in childbirth, and various other deities in the Greek pantheon could have had epithets pertaining to health, such as Athena Paeonia, healer. Later in the Hellenistic period, we see the rising importance of the Greco-Egyptian Serapis and Isis as healing gods. These sanctuaries attracted the sick and injured, where they hoped to undergo a process of healing that they otherwise were not finding through rational medicine. Typically, the sufferer would visit the temple and spend one or more nights sleeping within its walls. In a process known as incubation, the patients are visited in their dreams by the sanctuary's patron god, who heals them of their condition. This can present itself through a direct cure, symbolic action, or an herbal recipe. There are several inscriptions from Epidaurus dating to the late 4th century, no doubt specially curated by the priests of the sanctuary, relaying the success stories of the many supplicants who came seeking an epiphany from the gods. One notable example relays the tale of a former naysayer. Quote, "A man with the fingers of his hand paralyzed except for one came as a suppliant to the god, and when he saw the tablets in the sanctuary, he would not believe the cures, and was rather contemptuous of the inscriptions. But when he went to sleep, he saw a vision. He thought that as he was playing dice below the sanctuary and was about to throw the dice, the god appeared, sprang on his hand, and stretched out his fingers one by one. And when he had straightened them all out, the god asked him whether he still did not believe the inscriptions on the tablets in the sanctuary, and the man said he did. The god said, 'Since previously you would not believe them, although they are not incredible, in the future let your name be Incredulous.' When day came, he went away cured." End quote. While this may lead the more skeptical of us to view these activities in the same vein as faith healers or snake oil salesmen, the power of the placebo effect and genuine religious conviction cannot be downplayed. The belief that it was working to some capacity is attested to by the large amount of anatomical votives dedicated at these temples. These would be representations of the person's former afflicted area, whether it was limbs, eyes, or even genitalia. It also would be incorrect to assume that the veneration of Asclepius could not go hand in hand with rational medicine, as there are lines suggesting that it was an incorporation of pharmaceutical treatments at these sanctuaries as well. With the decline of the Hellenistic kingdoms, inertia carried much of classical and Hellenistic Greek medicine to the rising power of the Roman Republic. The cult of Asclepius was imported from Epidaurus by the Roman Senate in 293 to help combat epidemics that were ravaging the city, and a temple was erected on the Tiber Island. In 219, the Senate once again took the initiative by inviting one Archagathus of Sparta to be the first Greek doctor to set up practice in Rome, paid for by the state. Unfortunately, the relationship soured due to Archagathus' penchant for surgical treatments and bloodletting, which became so reviled that he was given the nickname Carnifex, Butcher, and was driven out of the city not long afterwards. Some Romans viewed Greek medicine with suspicion, and Cato the Elder went so far as to accuse the Hippocratics of conspiring against non-Greek patients. Though they may have tried to promote traditional Roman methods, the ways of the Greeks became increasingly fashionable as Greek doctors traveled to Rome in search of wealthy clients or were taken captive during the conquest of their homelands. A physician named Asclepiades of Bithynia managed to earn a great deal of popularity in Rome during the early 1st century BC, but rather than following the humoral practices of the dogmatists, he ascribed to Epicurean ideals of atomism and the movement of particles as being the root of health, a school of thought that eventually became known as Methodism. To encourage the immigration of trained physicians, both Julius and Augustus Caesar enacted laws that granted citizenship and tax immunity for practicing doctors living in Rome. Over time, medicine and the career of a physician became firmly associated with Greekness in the Roman mind, as many wealthy families had their own personal doctors, who were either of Greek ethnicity or possessed a Greek name. But perhaps this also secured its longevity, for the later Roman authors like Celsus and especially Galen would compile the medical treatises of the Hellenistic scientists, aiding in their long-term survival. The organization and preservation of the Hippocratic corpus was a consequence of the scholars working at the Library of Alexandria, and the works of Galen were transmitted into the medieval period. Relatively few medical texts survived in post-Roman Western Europe, for although Galen's ideas were highly influential, there were only a handful of Latin translations produced from the original Greek texts. Scribes working in the Eastern Roman Empire rescued many of the Greek manuscripts, but scholars in the Islamic world managed to save a handful of otherwise missing treatises as well, thanks to their translations in Syriac and Arabic. These in turn were translated back to Latin during the High and Late Middle Ages, sparking a renewed interest among scholars looking to verify the claims of the ancient physicians. The work of Herophilus and Erasistratus was validated nearly 2,000 years after their time, as European intellectual circles gradually saw the value of dissection, eventually leading to the challenging of Galen during the Renaissance and early modern period, and the rapid advancement of medicine in the subsequent centuries.